pussy sweeter than a sweetie when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area in earlier times, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll continue reading excerpts from Backyards, Bow Ties, and Beauty Queens, a collection of essays by Bill Thompson of Our State magazine, published in 2008. Everybody needs an anchor. Almost inevitably, certain people come to mind to remind us of particular times and places in our past. As I thought back over the last half century of my life, Paul Yoder came to my mind. In the years that I knew him, I never called him by his first name. He was always Dr. Yoder. He was the chairman of the music department at what was then Campbell College, now Campbell University, when I was a student there. In fact, my freshman year was his first year at Campbell as well. He was not what I expected a music professor to look like. He was a big man, standing more than 6 feet tall, and with a tendency to be a little heavy. When he walked, he appeared to plod. He took big steps, his big feet landing at a 45-degree angle from his body. His hair had begun to thin, and he combed it straight back. Because of the wispy nature of his hair, it never seemed to stay in place very long. I had only been on the Buies Creek campus a few days when I happened to read a notice on one of the bulletin boards notifying students that wanted to join the Campbell Choir to come by Dr. Yoder's office for auditions. I'd always liked to sing, so I just went in the music building, a connected group of old army barracks, and right into Dr. Yoder's office. He was sitting there at an old upright piano and greeted me as I opened the door. After I told him I wanted to audition for the choir, he got out an old hymn book and told me to sing Amazing Grace as he accompanied me. After that, he told me to sing the tenor line as he played. Then he picked out a song I had never heard and asked me to sing it. I couldn't read music, so I asked him to play it through one time. He did, and I sang it back to him just like he played it. He laughed and told me to report to the choir room the next day. I was to be a part of the Campbell College touring choir. For the next 4 years, I sang with that group. I learned a lot about choral music, about how to sing, and how to create music. I even thought at one time I would become a music major, but after a short, very short, tenure in music theory class, Dr. Yoder convinced me that I needed to consider another vocational endeavor. But he kept me in the touring choir. I was sometimes the only non-music major in the group, and the people in that choir became some of my closest friends. I guess the reason I think back on Dr. Yoder now is because he gave a very naive, untutored country boy from Hallsboro the opportunity to experience music and travel. More importantly, he allowed me to become a part of a group that gave me some sense of self-worth that I didn't have, a sense of accomplishment and recognition. Although he was always supportive, he was very frank with me. If I didn't perform up to my potential, he would tell me, in no uncertain terms, that I stunk, and my grade in that particular area would reflect his opinion. But he never let me quit. At one point, I became so frustrated that I went into his office to resign from the choir. He told me to go ahead, but if I did, to never speak to him again. I stayed. Even after I graduated, Dr. Yoder and I stayed in touch. For a period of time, I worked for Campbell University and saw Dr. Yoder almost every day. He became my friend as well as my counselor. Each year, there are other young people who leave the small towns of North Carolina and go on to the institutions of higher learning. I'm sure that many are just as dismayed as I was by the changes that take place in their lives when they leave the comfortable confines of family and familiar surroundings. But I wonder how many are as fortunate as I was to have someone like Dr. Yoder to provide an anchor in the turbulent sea of academia. How many will find a mentor to guide them? Are there any more like him around? The answer is yes. There are still teachers who care about their students, even as the pressures of bureaucratic education surround them. They will make their presence known to those who need them, and I hope those students will seek them out. Sleeve garters in a fertilizer warehouse. Sunlight shines through several small, dingy windows, casting beams of light through the clouds of dust. The dust is swirling, and there is a lot of movement of men pushing heavily loaded hand trucks through all the melee. But what makes the scene so surreal is the image of a man standing calmly amid it all. The man is fairly short, maybe 5.5 feet tall. He wears rimless spectacles and stands motionless with his arms folded. Although the summer temperature in the warehouse is above 100 degrees, he's wearing a tie and a long-sleeve white shirt, with sleeve garters. The sleeve garters are not an affectation. He's a broad-shouldered man with short arms, so his sleeves are a little long. The garters bring the cuffs up to his wrist. The incongruity of the scene is really a reflection of the personality of the man. He's standing in a fertilizer warehouse in a small North Carolina town in the 1950s. Selling fertilizer and other farm needs to the local farmers is his business. But he brings a dignity and sense of decorum to the position. To him, his job required a certain amount of aplomb. It was not a conceit, not a matter of considering himself any better than any of his customers. It was a role that he played that he found consistent with the time and the place. He wore a coat and tie every day, whether it was at the store, in the field, or at church. He didn't own a short-sleeved shirt. He said there was no such thing as a short-sleeved dress shirt. Every shirt was white and starched to the point that the heat and humidity of summer days before air conditioning never wilted the collar. He was a country store owner in the days when a country store was the financial center of so many rural communities. His customers could buy everything from fine lace to hog feed. Farmers would come to the store in the spring and sign a chattel mortgage to get the supplies they needed to plant their tobacco crop. I remember one such mortgage document that listed one black mule, a wagon, one good milk cow, and a sow and 6 pigs as collateral. During the summer and through the winter, those customers would charge everything to their account, including food and clothing. Then, each fall, they would come in and pay off that mortgage after they sold their tobacco. To Mr. Dave, as he was known, an image of a man dressed in a dignified suit and tie exuded confidence, a confidence that his customers could see. They needed to know that the store, in the incarnation of Mr. Dave, would be there regardless of the vagaries and vicissitudes of the farming business. Lord knows there was little enough certainty in farming anyway. There had to be some anchor. Most of the farmers who signed the chattel mortgages couldn't get a loan at the bank. Mr. Dave believed in his customers, and they believed in him. In all his years in business, he only foreclosed on 2 mortgages, and even then they were 5 years past due. Times have changed. Nobody does business that way anymore. Mr. Dave Council was my grandfather. He died fairly young while I was still in college, but I remember him for many things. He smoked a pack of unfiltered cool cigarettes every day, read his Bible every night, taught the men's Sunday school class every Sunday, and always arrived 15 minutes early for church. He was a man of regular habits who believed in hard work, cared about his neighbors, and loved his family. He had a great faith in his fellow man. He believed that people were essentially good. He believed that he should provide an anchor in a stormy sea of farming. I remember my grandfather every time I drive through the back roads of eastern North Carolina. I always see abandoned country stores, their false fronts weathered gray, the old porches sagging, and window panes broken. I see the old screen doors with the faint imprint of the Merita Bread logo still visible. There was a time when those stores were the center of a thriving community, and the storekeeper kept them all together. And he believed that you should always wear a tie with a long-sleeved white shirt with sleeve garters. Like coming home. Some time ago, I went up to Newton Grove in Sampson County to speak to their Committee of 100 annual meeting. The trip there, and the occasion itself, made me a mite wistful. I took a circuitous route, which took me first to Lumberton, then to Fayetteville, then to Newton Grove. It was probably the time of day, late afternoon, that made me remember why I'm so glad North Carolina is my home. When I turned off Interstate 95 onto U.S. Highway 13, the sun was lingering over the tops of the pine trees. With the sun setting behind me, the fading light showed me pictures of life as tranquil and poignant as a pastoral scene hanging in a museum. Fields, freshly plowed under after the recent harvest, stretched open and flat, the marks of the discs running like lines on a wrinkled sheet of gray paper. Acre after acre of cotton whiteness stood in stark contrast to the shadows cast by the surrounding woods. It looked as if the clouds of the daytime sky had descended to earth to rest for the night. I saw some children playing in the yard, burning off that last burst of energy before supper. It was a scene of innocence, a reminder of that spell of life before responsibility sweeps the innocence away. Sampson County is still mostly rural, reflecting the lifestyle that's so much a part of our heritage. There are certainly bigger farms now, but there are still many smaller farms that have yet to yield to the pressures of economy. Given that heritage, it was appropriate, I thought, that the meeting I was to attend, a meeting that addressed the economic concerns of the future of the area, was held in a small country church fellowship hall. When I stepped into the meeting room, I immediately felt at home. The ladies of the church were preparing a wonderful meal, ham and peas, homemade casseroles and cornbread, and other food that smelled and tasted like home. And, of course, there was plenty of sweet iced tea, along with cake for dessert. The folks that gathered for that meeting are like folks in so many other communities across North Carolina, hard-working, salt-of-the-earth people who want to do things together to make their communities a better place to live. After I ate the delicious food, a group of singers from the host church, Hopewell United Methodist, sang. The singers were all men who seemed to really enjoy what they were doing, and the lady who played the piano bound them together like a family. Most of them were kin to each other, a fact that probably added to the quality of their singing. They sang some familiar songs, some songs of the church, and some gospel songs, songs whose harmonies whispered and shouted of faith and glory. They were the kinds of songs that made me want to sing along with them. So I did, kind of under my breath. After the business came my turn. I gave my usual talk, sharing those things about North Carolina that make it such a special place to live. While I was talking, I realized that I was looking at what made this state special. People like those in Newton Grove and the hundreds of other similar communities across this state. It made me proud to be part of it all. Death of a Mule. John Henry Garrison's mule died the other day. The death in itself is worth mentioning, since the demise of a mule today is significant, given that few are left living. But it was the notice, rather than the death, of the passing of John Henry's mule that I thought significant. The mule was known as John Henry's Mule. That name, or lack thereof, tells you something about not only how folks felt about the mule, but also how John Henry thought of the mule. Sometimes in the South, mules take on a sentimental value because they represent a nostalgic past that surpasses any reality. But there was nothing sentimental about John Henry's mule. The mule was strictly utilitarian. He didn't need a name. "I bought him to plow my garden with," John Henry told me. "I had a good tractor, but it was too big to plow a little plot of ground like a garden. So I got a mule. Bought him at an auction over in Siler City. I had a bunch of plows and a harness that my daddy had left, so I just cleaned it up and put it on the mule. Bad thing about that was, the old harness wore out pretty soon, and I had to hunt all over the place to find a replacement. Never did get it all alike, just a piece here and there to get by. The first time I saw John Henry and his mule, I was visiting a man from Sanford, and we went to look at an old house next to John Henry's. We saw the man and mule plowing next to the house we wanted to see, but we didn't approach them. It's best not to interrupt a man while he's plowing. However, as we were walking around the house, John Henry came up and introduced himself, just checking on any visitors to the place. The owner lived elsewhere, and John Henry kind of kept an eye on it for him. Having always had an interest in mules, I commented on what a fine animal he was working. "Yeah, he does pretty good," he said. He went on to tell me about learning how to plow, since he had never really worked a mule before. I always thought this stuff about plowing straight rows was just some of my daddy's bragging. But I tell you the truth, it's a real accomplishment to be able to plow a straight row. Helps if the mule already knows how. We left the house, John Henry and his mule, and went on back to Sanford. I would go by the place many times in the course of the next year or so, and I always looked for the mule. He was usually standing alone in a small fenced-in area that contained a single-covered shed in one corner and a little pile of hay. One day, when I went by, I didn't see the mule, but I did see a pickup truck parked by the fence. I drove a little way down the road before my curiosity got the best of me. I turned around to go back and check on the status of the mule. John Henry was sitting there, emptying the water trough. When asked about the mule, he answered, "Yep, he just up and died." You ever notice how many things just up and? Die, move, quit, etc. That's a phrase we Southerners use to describe a lot of things we don't understand or know the reason for happening. I asked John Henry if he was going to buy another mule. He said he wasn't. They were too much trouble. As I was leaving, I noticed a mound of dirt beside the shed. I assumed it was the grave of the mule. A hand-painted wooden sign lay on the ground beside it. I figured it was to be the marker for the grave. It said, "John Henry's Mule." Dr. Scarlett O'Hara. I was looking through some old appointment calendars the other day and noticed the number of festivals and other celebrations that I've had the good fortune to be a part of over the years. Many of those festivals have included beauty pageants, for which I emceed. Admittedly, the number of participants in those pageants has declined in recent years. That's not to say that there aren't still plenty of young ladies who enjoy getting all dressed up, working on a talent presentation, and doing all the other things that will allow them to ride in parades, cut ribbons, and generally remind us that Scarlett O'Hara still lives. Beauty pageants are a typically Southern tradition. The popularity may have decreased nationwide, but not so much in the South. The restructuring of some contests, like the Miss America pageant, is supposed to make the business more relevant. And I guess it will. But hundreds of small towns still celebrate everything from vegetables to water and want to select the perfect young lady to exemplify the ideals of the community. Despite the protestations of feminists and other progressive groups, there's no lack of eager participants for the contests. Philosophically, I believe it has something to do with the Southern soul. Every Southern boy, whether he's a good old boy or an urbane sophisticate, still sees the perfect woman up on a pedestal, radiant in a sequined gown, waving and smiling, allowing her subjects to marvel. Sometimes in the course of the pageant, it becomes apparent that the parents or the girl's friends have played a major role in getting the girl to enter the pageant. She's in it for the fun of it, just to be part of the group, and winning isn't her real goal. Such was the case in a pageant I emceed several years ago in the Piedmont section of the state. Back then, a part of the competition required the contestant to come out on the stage in her evening gown and walk around a little before approaching the MC, who would ask the girl a question prepared by the judges. The girl would be judged on how pretty she looked in her gown, her poise, and how well she answered the question. This particular young lady had been having a great time during rehearsals, and I could tell she was in the event just for the fun of it. But her on-stage question was serious. She had told the judges during the interview process that morning that she intended to go to college after graduating from high school with the ultimate goal of becoming a doctor. Being a doctor or a television journalist are the two big occupations for a lot of pageant contestants. So when she came out for her evening gown presentation and interview portion, I read the note I had been given by the judges. You said earlier that you planned to go to medical school and become a doctor. Going to medical school will involve a considerable amount of laboratory work and may necessitate your working with a cadaver. How would you feel about working with a cadaver? There was a long pause. The girl asked me to read the question again, which I did. Then she said, I know that becoming a doctor is a challenging goal. I haven't really had a lot of experience yet in working in a laboratory, but I pride myself on being able to work with anybody, so I guess I could work with a cadaver. Besides, two heads are always better than one. Miss Scarlet could not have said it better. For the Love of a Peanut. From time to time I feel compelled to talk about boiled peanuts, especially when somebody asks me what's so special about them. I take that as a challenge to once again explain my feelings for one of God's greatest creations. There are some who say that boiled peanuts are not fit to eat. Those who say that are usually born north of Raleigh, and were introduced to this wonderful delicacy at a late point in their lives. My grandson was born in Charlotte. His father was born in Chicago, and, although he has lived in the South long enough to have acquired the taste, he refuses to accept boiled peanuts for the Epicurean delight that they are. Therefore, I feel compelled to introduce my grandson to his cultural legacy as soon as he's old enough to chew solid food. Boiled peanuts are the caviar of Carolina cuisine. It's a part of our culture, as unique as shagging at the beach or making homemade ice cream at the church picnic. Eating boiled peanuts has been an integral part of our lives. There's a special joy in pulling the plants out of the moist soil and savoring that aroma that portends the taste to come. Every boiled peanut lover has stood anxiously by a pot of boiling water filled with raw peanuts and periodically scooped out one or two to see if they were ready. The anxiety of waiting for the peanuts to simmer in the salt water was a test of willpower. For many of us, some of our most cherished childhood memories include boiled peanuts. Many of our grandmothers introduced us to the peanut boiling process as they prepared the nuts in a big iron pot set over an open fire in the backyard. After the long wait for the boiling and simmering, we were treated to big bowls full of hot peanuts. We ate the big ones first, sucking the tasty salt water out of the shells, and the pops that had no peanuts weren't excluded. Peanut boilings served as the cause for us all to get together. Sometimes it was for a song fest, where we would all gather around the piano, maybe with a guitar and a banjo, too, and sing songs from the hymn book, or ones that we'd heard on the radio. Some would sing, while others ate peanuts. When tobacco was cured in wooden barns and somebody had to stay up all night to feed wood to the furnace, neighbors would come over, boil peanuts, and sit around and tell stories. It was always a sure sign that the tobacco market had opened when the peanut boys were set up on the street corners downtown, and you could hear them hawk their wares all the way down the street. My first trip to the tobacco market meant that my father would buy me a Pepsi and a bag of boiled peanuts, and then place me on top of one of those neatly stacked piles, not loose-leaf sheets, of tobacco there in the warehouse, and tell me to stay there until he got back. I was glad to do so. Boiled peanuts are still around. You can find them in most of the convenience stores all year round, thanks to modern refrigeration. Every once in a while in the summer, you may see a vendor set up a roadside stand where the peanuts are being boiled in stainless steel cookers that look like the remnants of a liquor still. Then you can buy them hot. Real boiled peanut connoisseurs cook their own peanuts at home, eat as many as they can while they're hot, then put the remainder in freezer bags to store until Christmas, when they'll bring them back out to warm up, just to tide us over until summer's return. The price of a bag of boiled peanuts has escalated considerably since I was a boy. I paid over $1 a bag for hot peanuts the other day. Hot boiled peanuts. Worth every cent. If you miss the train I'm on. I miss the trains. I miss the sound of them, the rumbling of the earth as they pass, and the diminishing noise that fades into silence as they disappear into the distance. Many years ago, they took up the railroad tracks in Hallsboro, and life for me and the other residents there hasn't been the same. One day, I recalled that sense of awe that I used to get from watching the train pass. I had stopped my car at a railroad crossing near Hamlet as a train was going by. It was one of those long, long connections of boxcars. Since I couldn't see the front or the end of the train, I decided to get out of my car and see if I could still feel the rumble and the roar. Sure enough, there was a great roar. The noise seemed to sweep over me. The speed of the passing boxcars enveloped me. I was reminded of the cliché that tornado survivors use to describe the approach of the storm. It sounded just like a freight train coming through. In a way, I was as swept up by that moment as if I were in the midst of a tornado. I was aware of the size of the procession, each car almost the size of some mobile homes, as they flashed by me like earthbound rockets. I felt so insignificant standing there as the lettering on the sides of the cars blurred into an incomprehensible stream of meaningless graffiti. Then came the caboose, and I watched it recede down the track. The noise grew fainter until it was replaced with that silence that seems so deep in contrast to the recent clatter. I remained standing in the middle of the empty road. I could still feel the passing of the train, even as the sight and sound disappeared. Trains are a big part of our lives, whether we're aware of this fact or not. The development of trains parallels the growth of this country and is an indicator of the changes that have taken place. Much of the transport of goods is now by truck. Long-distance passenger travel has shifted to airplanes and automobiles. Things change. Maybe trains are still around because there's something romantic about trains. They generate visions like trips on the Orient Express in pursuit of some foreign spy, or the idea of hobos traveling free across the countryside. There's even a certain amount of romanticism attached to watching a train from the loading dock of a railroad station in a small North Carolina town on a summer's day, and waving at the engineer as he roars by. I wish I could do that again, but I can't. They took up the tracks. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening.
I think we can hear what I say. Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.